Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mary Lou Hilberg, and I represent Anul Ram. When I was thinking about this case, I thought an analogy to work I like to do in my spare time as a gardener. And when I get to a plant and I start pruning it, sometimes it doesn't look anything like the plant that started. But the roots are the same, the DNA is the same, it's the same plant. When I'm appointed as habeas counsel and I get a pro per petition, especially by a mentally ill client, which are the clients that I get, I need to do a major prune. And to be honest, Your Honors, if I had known then what I know now about the relation back doctrine, I think I would have pled it a little bit more fully in going back again to my algebra teacher who was always saying, show your work, show how you got from here to here. But when it comes down to brass tacks in this case, it's essentially the same claim of involuntariness of the plea. She said she was, the whole thing, both counts were involuntary because she was mentally ill and legally incompetent at the time.
And can I just ask that?
Sure.
That claim seems pretty legitimate, but it's been abandoned. And I guess I just don't quite understand why you shifted from her petition to the claim that you're now trying to pursue.
Honestly, it was a strategic decision based on the difficulty of the facts of this case in front of a jury versus a second-degree murder conviction, because it started as a first-degree murder with special circumstances. And I thought long and hard. I had long discussions with trial counsel. I had long discussions with Ms. Ram. And that was just a strategic decision.
But your claim now is just limited to the, trying to remember, it's the attempted murder conviction?
Right.
And I guess I'm just not even clear on what strategic value there would be if you were to prevail, if she were to prevail on that claim, because does she just want to hurry up and go start serving the 15 to life?
Actually, Justices, at the time I wrote the petition, I believed that she would. She was in the process of being referred for a restoral of sanity to go to prison. She's now been in prison for all this year, and
so she's already serving the 15 to life.
She's already serving the prison.
Then there's no value to your prevailing on this claim.
At the time I wrote the petition, I believed, and I believe the correct interpretation of California law was that she was going to get no credit for the time that she was in Napa.
I see.
However, subsequently, and I shared this with counsel this morning, that was proven wrong. And I do believe that the reason is because of the intervention of Proposition 57, which has widespread changes to the law of credits in the state of California, including it specifically says that credits will be awarded for time in treatment.
So she will get credit for all the time she spent in Napa.
That's how CDCR has figured it.
Why are we here?
Well, I just learned this in the last week, but what does remain is she pled to another count of a non-existent crime, and it's a strike. So if Ms. Ram ever does get to parole, it has a huge potential impact if she ever reoffends, which honestly I don't think if any client I've ever had, I think she's less likely to reoffend. But in my job, I've said that before, so I have to be real about it. But at the time, and the other thing, honestly, is I've read Anderson in the last few days that was decided by, I believe, a different panel of this court, and rethought maybe I was incompetent for not prevailing with the original. She was incompetent at the time of the plea, because I do believe she was.
I do, too. That's why I don't understand why you, because it's not even like you tried to add a claim. That would make sense, right? But to have abandoned the claim that seemed like on its face, she was, at the same time she was being allowed to enter this plea, she was also sent off to Napa. It just seems like right there, there's something's not right about that outcome. Don't you agree?
Yes.
I mean, especially given the circumstances of the crime, I mean, my goodness.
But if we, at the same time as her counsel, I'm not just the appellate attorney, I'm the attorney for her best interests overall. And if I believe that she stood a substantial risk of getting a worse outcome at trial than the second-degree murder for the death of her daughter, which is given, Sacramento County is not exactly known for being bleeding heart liberals, in my humble opinion, and the facts of this case were really, really, really hard.
So even if you had been successful in getting the plea vacated, she still would have faced the charges, obviously, and could have been convicted, I suppose.
That was the fear, and that, as I said, that was not a quickly considered decision. That was a long, difficult struggle.
So I've taken up too much time on collateral matters. Why don't you address the issue that is before us? Because as I see it, the factual basis for the original claim is completely distinct from the claim that you now want to pursue. Claim you now want to pursue has to do with the things that she did, putting aside her sanity, her competency, all that. They just don't add up to an offense at all, right?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you last said.
So the claim you want to pursue now,
yes,
is that what she did in the real world, it just doesn't even add up to a crime, right? She just told her son, I don't know, to get undressed, so he,
yes,
get in, right? And there's no crime there.
Right.
But that has nothing to do with the factual basis for the claim that she originally alleged. That's why I just think.
Well, the problem is that in plea bargaining, the United States Supreme Court in Alward gave a wide discretion, as long as it's knowing and voluntary. You can plead guilty to a crime that you didn't do. They can make one up. You know, that's really clear. But it has to be knowing and voluntary. You have to know what you're doing, and you have to make a conscious choice. And that's where the claim is exactly the same. She's saying, I didn't know. I didn't know this was a legal fiction. The attorney admitted it was a legal fiction. She's saying, I didn't know that. You know, I wouldn't have gone along with a legal fiction. I didn't, you know, so it's involuntary. It's still ill-advised. And the fact that she was mentally ill at the time adds to the unknowing or unintelligent nature of the plea. She said, I just want to point out specific references, and that is in her original petition, which is an EOR 134. She said she was mentally incompetent. It was an involuntary plea. That's exactly what we're saying here, too. It's involuntary if she's not intelligently advised. And then she also said that she didn't, in EOR 143, that she didn't understand the legal process and her rights were violated. And this is the specific place where I'm saying, yes, I think her rights were violated here. So I'd like to reserve what remaining time I have for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, Tammy Krenzen for the respondent. To relate back, we look at whether there's a common core of operative facts.
Before you get to that, would you tell me, do you agree with Ms. Hilberg's statement that the petitioner now gets full credit for all the time in Napa against?
I cannot confirm or deny that, Your Honor. I haven't checked into what her credits are and what her time served would be or not. So she mentioned that to me this morning and said that, and certainly that might go to an issue of potential if we got to an answer on the merits, whether things were moot and remedy, but we haven't gotten there yet, and honestly, I can't say what her eligible parole date is as of today.
All right, thank you.
You're not troubled at all by the outcome in this case? Because I guess I find myself deeply troubled by how this unfolded.
Actually, no, Your Honor. In looking at this case, I've been reviewed it for quite a long time, and on the face of it, you look at it and you say, what happened here? And when I've gone through particular excerpts of record and everything that was said and done, and again, we're obviously on the merits of this right now, I think her attorney got a great deal for her.
Was she evaluated before entering the plea? Was she evaluated to see whether she was competent to stand trial at any point?
She was not evaluated whether she was competent to stand trial. She was evaluated to determine if a not guilty by reason of insanity plea was appropriate. So at the time of her crime, there was evaluation as to what her mental state was then. In looking at the plea proceedings, she said she fully understood her rights. The court didn't raise any question. Counsel didn't raise any question.
But what I'm saying is that at the same time she was allowed to enter the plea, supposedly a fully knowing and voluntary plea, she was immediately sent off to Napa, wasn't she? And had spent the next 3, 4, 5 years trying to be restored to sanity. So how could the plea at time one have been knowing and voluntary? That's what troubles me, right?
Well, I think you have to look at the two different time periods. A plea of not guilty by reason of insanity has to do with what happened at the time of the crime.
Right.
Her competence to stand trial is a separate time period. And actually, if you look in
But you're saying that she was never evaluated before she entered the plea. Between the time of the offense and the time she entered the plea, I thought you said that she was never evaluated to see whether she was competent.
Not that, to my knowledge. There's nothing on the record that says she was evaluated. And if counsel wasn't concerned or the court wasn't concerned, and I think it's important to note that she actually, at the time of the plea proceedings, said on the record she was taking Risperdal. She was being medicated. She was in the jail. She was receiving treatment.
Okay, but so I'm with you that the time periods are different, but all I'm saying is that from the time she entered the plea till, I don't know, years afterwards, she was deemed not sane, right? I mean, her sanity hadn't been deemed restored until just recently. That's my
She entered a plea, so it appears so she could get treatment, because I don't think anyone could question that there's mental health issues.
She wasn't in her right mind for years after she entered the plea. I'm just saying that seems strange.
I think there's a big difference between having mental health issues and whether you are actually competent to stand trial. It's a much different standard.
That's why I was asking, was she ever evaluated? And you said no. So we don't know, and everything we do know about the time from the time she entered the plea forward for several years suggests that there were probably major issues she was suffering from at the time she entered the plea.
But under federal constitutional law, which again, we're discussing an issue we're at the procedural stage, but and under federal constitutional law, though, unless counsel or the court has a reason to believe, and if she's medicated, being treated, and she is able to understand the proceedings and able to assist her counsel, which based on the change of plea proceedings appears she was able to do that, there's no reason to question her competency. There's no reason to question. What she did at the time of the crime, she may not have been medicated at that time. She may not have been getting treatment. She's now in jail receiving treatment, and she's appearing in court, and she's saying, I understand all my rights. If you look at the plea proceedings, which are in the excerpt of record, if the court continues to be concerned about this, the change of plea proceedings are at ER 7384. She's asked questions. She's asked if she understands her rights. Does she understand what she's given up? She continues to say, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Her attorney says she refused to go to trial. She didn't want to go to trial.
She wanted to die. Right?
She wanted to go to prison. She didn't say I don't know if she wanted to die or not. She said she wanted to go to prison.
Thought she wanted to.
And
she was so distraught over what she had done that she wanted things to end.
And that doesn't, even if that's true, that doesn't equate to mental incompetency.
Oh, I know. That's why I'm just shocked, though, that no evaluation was done. In light of what happened in terms of the circumstances of the crime and what they were contemplating doing in terms of sending her to Napa, it just seems crazy that she wasn't given a full scale.
Telling is she was on Risperdal at the time of the plea proceedings, and that is the very drug that, if you look at the declarations by the staff at the mental hospital, that helped her as far as regaining, not hearing voices and hallucinations. And again, I'm assuming all these things are true. We haven't gotten to that stage, but assuming all that's true, if she's receiving treatment and drug that was working for her, she could very well be competent at the time of trial, but continue to need treatment. And I think her attorney was doing his best to make sure she was getting the treatment she needed, which now has put her in a much better place for parole, has given her a chance. She had a charge of life without the possibility of parole hanging over on some facts that were very concerning and some evidence that she understood what was going on. I don't think there's any dispute, could be any dispute. She had mental health issues, but her insanity or her competence at the time of the proceedings are separate issues than that.
I agree. I just don't see, I don't know. Were you the prosecutor who made the charging decision in this? I just think it was overcharged.
Well, first of all, it's not fair to put me in the prosecutor because I haven't talked to the client. I don't know what information he had. And when I look at this, and
he just asked the question,
I'm just curious.
Were you the prosecutor?
Oh, I'm sorry.
He asked you if you were the prosecutor who made the charging decision.
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you.
Don't get defensive for no reason.
No, I just thought he said, would you have done that if you were the prosecutor? So just quickly on the relation back issue, the facts as alleged in the original timely petition relating to her depression, delusions, wanting to go to prison, actually, I'm sorry, you are right, to kill herself, that she wasn't assessed, and her competency can in no way establish the claim that's now in her amended complaint that there was insufficient factual basis for her attempted murder charge.
What about the argument that counsel made that what she's trying to argue in this new claim is connected to the old claim because she's saying that the plea wasn't knowing and voluntary because she wasn't properly advised about the fact that actually what you did with respect to the son could not ever be deemed a crime.
But again, we're looking at the facts, not legal theories. We don't relate legal theories. The time and type requirement refers to facts. And the facts of whether she was competent to stand trial, whether she was depressed, delusional, suicidal, whether she received a competency evaluation is entirely different than whether she was advised that the facts or her acts actually constituted the crime of attempted murder. It's completely separate in time and type. Those facts are completely different. And what's telling is that those facts are not in the original petition, are not in the amended petition to even support the claim. They're nowhere to be found. And it's because they can't support the claim. Those facts, if true, would not establish the claim.
Speaking of the original petition and the amended petition and so forth, we have a 28-J letter, right, on this new case. What's the name of it? Ross versus Williams. You have any comment on that case?
I cited that case in abundance of caution in case the court were inclined to look beyond the original pleading to try to pull facts and what she meant and things of that nature. And I think that case makes clear you have to allege all the facts, all your legal support in your petition, and you don't go looking elsewhere to try to get her intent or to pull other facts.
In your view, if we do that in this case, right, what does that mean? That means it's a new claim or it's not the same claim?
I'm sorry, you're saying...
What does it mean if we do that, if we follow the teaching of Ross?
The claim, there's nothing incorporated here. And again, if this case was cited in abundance of caution, she hasn't tried to incorporate anything. But if for some reason somebody was trying to go beyond, liberally construe the petition to go beyond the four corners of the document, that simply can't do that according to Ross versus William, as well as Rule 2C and Mail versus Felix says the same thing. And unless there's any further questions, I'll submit.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Briefly, the court is absolutely right that she didn't get evaluated under 1368, and the reason is honestly because defense counsel did not realize how sick she was. There's a declaration, EOR 118-19, from one of her treating psychologists at Napa about how, because of her cultural background as a Hindu woman in a more of a third world country and married in an abusive relationship where she was incredibly passive. And that's what she was trained to do. Yes, yes, sir, no, no, sir. You know, it was, that's what she did. She gave the expected answer. And the trial counsel did not know how suicidal she was. He knew she wanted to die, but he didn't know how bad it was. I would also suggest that you, and she was in, the other point I wanted to make is she was in Napa for 7 years, not three, four, or five. And if you look at Dr. Skill's declaration, another treating psychiatrist from Napa at 120, he changed her meds to add a second antipsychotic. And that's what started to turn things around. But that wasn't until about year six. And it's exactly in his declaration. And last but not least, in my last 10 seconds, I would like to say it's so fundamentally unfair to expect Ms. Ram to understand what a legally insufficient crime is when she couldn't know that she couldn't be guilty of second-degree or attempted murder of her son simply because she thought it. She thought she was guilty because she thought she wanted to do that at the time because her voices told her. And she felt guilty, even if the law didn't. So that's why she pled guilty. But that's not knowing an involuntary plea, and it doesn't meet with due process.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The next case on calendar is Cone and Cone Asset Management versus Hanson and Farball.